Lasting into the afternoon as well. A few brighter spells in the evening time with a few showers as well. So a wet old day and cool at 11 degrees. In Scotland, a cloudy start to the day. Outbreaks of rain arrive across southern and central areas by the end of the day. Across the north and west, though, it should stay dry and bright with sunny spells. Here, temperatures could reach around 12 or 13 degrees. That's the latest forecast. It's back to Luke now.
Chris, thank you. Now on Radio 4, historic Heston. And Heston Blumenthal explains, with a little help from Hugh Dennis, how a culinary sleight of hand in the 15th century inspired him to try a little trickery of his own.
Pomdoris, 1430. Take fillets of raw porker, and grind him well. Do salt and powder pepper thereto. Then take the white of the aeroon and throw thereto, and make fire without a smoke. Then take almond milk and debonted flour. Do hem togetheris. Take sugar, and put in thin batour. Then door hem with some green thing, parsley or yolks of aeroon, together that they ben green. And be well ware that they ben not brown. And some men boil him in fresher broth, or they ben spetted. And when they ben so boiled, then they must ben setter and kellid. And then spet hem, and dora hem with yolks of aeroon, emmenged with the juice of hasseleloys.
I first came across meat fruit, or rather pomdoris, which roughly translates as apple of gold, when the food historians at Hampton Court, Mark Meltonville and Richard Fitch, sent me a photograph of a recipe they tried out in the palace kitchens. It came, they explained, from the Harley collection, an enormous set of manuscripts originally amassed by Robert Harley, who was the first Lord of the Treasury from 1711 to 1714, and his son Edward. Pomdoris looked like an apple, but it was in fact minced pork that had been fashioned into a ball, coated in a skin made from a paste of flour and green herbs, spit roasted, then glazed with eggs and hazel leaf juice towards the end of cooking. It was served to guests among all the other platters of food as a surprise to be sprung at a feast, and it was indeed served at one of the biggest feasts of the period, the meal celebrating the coronation of Henry IV in 1399. I took to the idea at once. Now, much of what we know about eating in the Middle Ages comes one way or another from feasts. There are few written records, and those we do have, they're not cookery books as such, but household accounts or reminders for chefs about how to prepare the dishes. By the 1300s, these formal meals had developed into grand affairs, consisting of several courses, during which the table would groan with an extravagant mixture of sweet and savoury dishes.
The first course for a feast attended by Richard II in 1397 offered venison, capons, a boar's head, a couple of large tarts and roast swans, herons and pheasants. It was followed by roast pig, rabbits, curlews, venison, peacocks, teal, custard and fritters, with a final course of dates in syrup, roast cranes and plovers, larks, more peacocks, this time gilded, apple fritters and cheese and quince dumplings.
Now, you might think that this was simply the host, Lord Spencer, pushing the boat out because he was entertaining royalty. But the bills of fare for manorial households of the period show a similar abundance.
At a New Year's feast at the Acton estate of Dame Alice de Bryan in the early 1400s, 2 pigs, 2 swans, 12 geese, 2 joints of mutton, 24 capons, 17 rabbits, beef, veal, suckling pig, and a variety of sweet dishes were served up to 300 people.
An elaborate series of dishes was only part of what was on offer. The gap between the courses would be filled by the presentation of some subtlety, a sort of food sculpture, sometimes edible and sometimes not, designed to impress the guests. This might take the form of a cooked swan, or a peacock decorated with a gilded beak, its body slashed and striped with brilliant colours. or sugar moulded into wild animals, or even scenes from the Bible. Increasingly, these performance pieces were joined by other forms of entertainment, acrobats, jugglers, magicians, or musicians. Feasts in the latter Middle Ages were punctuated by three structured diversions. The disguising, in which characters, probably from the household itself, would appear disguised in outlandish costumes, the mumming, in which some form of mime would take place, and the interlude, in which a short play would be enacted. And with all this going on, it's no wonder that observers had difficulty conveying what they'd seen and eaten. After one of Henry VIII's feasts, Cardinal Wolsey's gentleman usher, George Cavendish, wrote,
"But to describe the dishes, subtleties, the many strange devices and order in the same, I do both lack wit in my gross old head and cunning in my bowels to declare the wonderful and curious imaginations in the same invented and devised."
The motives behind this style of dining are familiar. Meals were opportunities to demonstrate status, power, and wealth. Food cooked using dramatic or out-of-season ingredients, flavoured with expensive imported spices, showed how refined the host was in comparison with the lowly peasant and his bowl of pottage. Inviting guests to a memorable dinner that was as dramatic as it was gastronomically advanced was a great way to win powerful friends and influence people. In this respect, the medieval feast was little different from today's business lunch at a smart restaurant or a catered box at a sporting event. It was also about sheer entertainment, of course. The food at the feast had to be delicious, but like the mummers or tumblers, it was also expected to entertain. Medieval cookery manuscripts contain recipes for turning white wine into red before the diner's eyes, or preparing a chicken so that it appears to spring from the serving platter. The taste for counterfeiting even stretched to the tableware.
There are several recipes for puzzle jugs, in which a vessel riddled with holes appears miraculously to hold the liquid poured into it. Similarly, Tantalus cups, with concealed hollows and tubes, made sure that the drinker either found that the wine disappeared as they lifted the cup to their mouth, or that it all came out at once, soaking them completely.
Pomodoros belonged to this tradition of disguise and illusion. There was, of course, the sheer pleasure of the artistry of the dish, the chef's skill at transforming one thing into another. But the dish was also a tease. In the Middle Ages, people were often wary about eating raw fruit. Unwitting diners would approach Pomodoros with caution, only to discover that not only was the fruit not raw, it wasn't even fruit. And since the customs of the feast drew heavily on religious imagery and practices, it seems likely that diners would have been reminded of the apple on the tree of knowledge. Just like Eve, they would get a surprise when they bit in. I find this medieval taste for culinary games really exciting because it's always been a feature of my cooking, from nitro scrambled egg and bacon ice cream to hot and iced tea. So it was something of a revelation when I discovered that chefs of the Middle Ages had taken a similarly playful approach. It was inspiring to find that I was part of a long-standing culinary tradition. Gradually, as I started exploring historical dishes, a modus operandi had developed. I begin by following the original recipe as closely as I can, in order to get a clear idea of the chef's intentions and the overall look, feel and taste of the dish. With Pomodoros, it was obvious that what the chef wanted above all was for the apple to be as convincing as possible. Naturally, he'd want it to have great flavour and texture, but the illusion was paramount. However, in the 1400s, the most common method of cooking was spit roasting, a relatively crude system that must have made the chef's ambitions difficult to realise. In terms of technology, I certainly had the edge. My job, it seemed to me, was to take advantage of modern-day equipment to create a meat fruit that the medieval chef could only dream of. A dish that, were he to be transported to my kitchen in a time machine, would appeal to his wit and, who knows, perhaps the cunning in his bowels as well. Although meat fruit is an unusual concept, the components are pretty familiar. Minced and cooked meat appears in any number of dishes, from burgers and bangers to terrines and pâtés, and the French classical tradition includes all kinds of forcemeat stuffing, so I had a pretty broad range of techniques to choose from. I'd even already worked on a way of creating a skin. At the Fat Duck, I serve asparagus with salmon that's been coated in a licorice gel. The salmon is briefly dipped into a licorice stock containing a setting agent. Once the fish is removed, the coating cools and sets almost immediately, giving the fish a lovely, glossy black covering. There seemed no reason why I couldn't do something similar with stock made from something green, probably parsley or watercress, to create a nice, shiny apple skin. However, as my development chefs will attest, I've got a bit of a habit of turning a technical challenge into something altogether more complicated. Why stop at an apple, I asked myself. Why not try out all kinds of fruit to see which works best? The idea was just irresistible, in spite of the hugely increased workload. Each fruit had to have a filling with a texture and flavour that suited it. Now that meant mincing and cooking a variety of meats over and over again, in many different ways and at many different temperatures, until we found the ones that ate the best and went well with a particular skin. And each type of skin would, of course, have its own set of ingredients to be refined and revised. Patiently, we worked our way through the fruit bowl and found combinations that just made sense, such as grapes made of hubugo ham minced with onion and a bread paste to bind it together, and a mandarin with foie gras parfait inside that I thought was particularly delicious. For each fruit, I developed a coating made from a mixture of fruit puree, fructose, natural colouring, and an essential oil to intensify the flavour. Each one then had to go through the same laborious process of testing. I added a specific amount of gelatine, then warmed the mixture to a particular temperature, looking for the point at which it set to an even and delicate layer around the meat. If the mixture was heated too far above the temperature at which the gelatine set, it solidified too slowly, and the mixture either ran off or could only be built up in layers, which made the skin uneven and gave clues as to how it had been created. I definitely didn't want my diners to divine the trick. Maintaining the illusion was just as important to me as it must have been to the chefs who hoped to amaze with pommes dorées. If, on the other hand, the mixture wasn't warmed enough so that it hovered around gelatine's setting point, it set almost immediately, producing a layer that was too thick and made for a less satisfying eating experience. Trial and error and endless digital probing and tabulating of results led to the establishment of the optimal temperature for creating the perfect skin, which was slightly different for each fruit. By this stage, I'd already singled out the mandarin as the most likely candidate for the menu at my restaurant dinner, but then something extraordinary tipped the balance completely in its favour. During one session of skin dipping, we were interrupted and decided to freeze the coated mandarins, reserving them for future experimentation. Later, when we re-dipped the mandarins, I discovered that a second dunking, provided it was done when the surface was still speckled with frost from the freezer, had an amazing effect on the fruit. All over the surface were tiny little pop marks, just like the skin of a real citrus fruit. It was so unexpected, I just stood there with a giant grin on my face. And I was pretty sure it would have the same effect on diners at the restaurant too.
Service, please. Four meat fruit for table one, please. Go.
Heston Blumenthal and Hugh Dennis have been reading from Historic Heston. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions for BBC Radio 4. And now time for the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Wednesday the 16th of October. There are warnings of gales in White, Portland, Plymouth, Biscay, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet and Irish Sea. The general synopsis at 1800, new low moving rapidly northeastwards, expected northern England 996 by 1800 on Wednesday. New high expected South Fitzroy 1022 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking north at Cera. Northerly 4 or 5. Showers, good. South at Cera, variable 3.